For those of you who are here early, we're recognizing that people will be here at, on Holden time, maybe at 5 after. So, but this is a book that's become now a great gift to those of us who share the story of grief. It's called Tear Soup. So we'll just watch some of it, maybe watch it again later. We gather here this weekend as midges, those that come alongside with our own accompanying grief letters.
So we're here to talk about what death really looks like, the external part and the internal part, and how we do it. So I was thinking this morning about different ways that people do death, and thinking about the people dying. And there, I have some very close experience to like the two opposite ends of the spectrum. There are people who are prepared for their death, whatever that means, and there are people who are not. And my two examples are my parents. My father was an active alcoholic until he died, and he was so not prepared. He had cancer, he was requiring tons of pain medication, he was terrified. He lay in his hospital bed, he started hallucinating, his body was ready to go, and he was one of these spirits who was terrified. The Sharps container was directly across the room from him, and it became Mickey Mouse, and he was terrified of Mickey Mouse. So we just covered it, and it went away. There were acoustic tiles in the ceiling. He was an author, and those were unfinished manuscripts up there. All the little dots were letters on a piece of paper, and he just focused on that. It was awful. And then as he lost his verbal ability, he was physically agitated. Just he did not rest. He did not rest. And it was really painful to watch. And those of us who've been around death have seen our share of unsettled spirits, who the spirit is not settled. And I really believe that part of our mission in being here, part of my mission, is to get more settled in myself with what this is all about, what death is all about, and to resolve my own grieving. I don't know if grief is ever completely resolved, but to find a place for it and to free me up to be more available in the world. On the other end of the spectrum was my mother, who lived through my father's death. And she was a hospice volunteer at one point in her life, but she died slowly at home, and we did not have hospice in. We had me, but we had tons of family. She'd been preparing for years. She had labeled all the goods with different color stickers for each of the kids, and we always joked about we were going to move the stickers around as soon as she died. One of the things that she did in preparing for death is she had me call each of her still living close friends around the country, tell them what was going on, and then hand the phone to her. I still tear up thinking about that. It was so incredible. And each of her friends, after those conversations for years afterwards, have said to me, that was the most incredible experience for them. She was ready. She had her paperwork in order. She was spiritually ready. She was cognizant pretty much to the end. She had a great deal of pain also. And she had family around. On a very personal level, I have both ends, and of course I know which way I'd like to go, as we all would, but we deal with unexpected deaths all the time, and we have quite a few people here who have personal and professional experience with that. But part of what I've been charged with is the physical part of death. And I maintain there is really no separation between the two, that spiritual death affects the physical death affects the spiritual. And it's all wrapped up in emotional. It all has to do with who we were, who we are, where we're going.
I think we could also say that while we all want to have a good death, it's not ours on the outside to define what that is.
No, that's true.
We watch people labor till their last breath, and if Martha were here, she would tell you how her brother-in-law had the open mouth breathing moments before he died, and still somehow he was smiling at the stories and the hugs and the laughter that was gathered around him until his last breath. So they're held in that kind of the finish line. Or those of you who knew Colleen, that death was, we could say, orchestrated in some ways, and she died the way she lived, and we all do, basically. So I think we want to be just knowing that people's death, or however their death is, a good death, a bad death, whatever, we could maybe not judge that so much as observe it and recognize it and be the parts that we are next to people along the journey, and let them do and be how they do and be till the last breath. You were talking about what it looks like.
So I have come to see the physical, well, and emotional part of death as like a series of doors that are just quietly closing. And with the body begins to shut down as you get close to death. And it starts at the outside and it works towards the inside. And so what we see physically is the manifestation of the doors closing. The appetite dwindles. The body starts to shut down. The blood supply to the brain changes. The blood supply to the extremities changes. Some confusion can set in. The breathing changes. So what that might look at, like from head to toe, that with confusion, somebody might sort of, it seems like they're coming and going from reality, but then what's reality in that state? So it becomes our reality watching this. And how do we support that? I think what I have seen is it's reassuring to somebody who's in that to remind them who you are and what you're doing, what's going on. The there's, it'll be better, don't really go anywhere. And allowing them the space to come and go from whatever realities they are dealing with, it has a calming effect. If I am there saying, no, you're here in this room with these people and this is what's going on, those people are already dead, or that happened 50,000 years ago, or whatever, that's not particularly helpful. Because another thing that can happen, and often does, is agitation, that people get physically more active. They have a hard time settling, picking at things, or just really having a hard time settling, like my description of my father, but that was kind of extreme. And again, I don't think that there's really help. I think that's when, commercial break. I was a mother baby nurse for a long time before I became a hospice nurse. And by the way, in the bio it says 8 years, it's more like 20. But with little babies, with newborns, when we want to calm a newborn, we use slow, gentle movements. when we want to wake a baby up because they're not eating enough. We jiggle them, we talk to them, we stimulate them. And so I take that to the other side of life. If somebody is agitated, trying to bring them back to where we are is not helpful. But the gentle, our music is of course wonderful, reading, just being there, the physical touch, and the calmness. I have seen that bring agitation right down. Of course, lorazepam works, but other things work too. So that's the agitation, and then the breathing. And the breathing is, for the most part, metabolic. It's more doors shutting. It's more systems changing within the body. And so you might see some really fast breathing and then nothing. And the family gets around like this, are they gone? And then the person goes and takes a really deep breath. And that can go on for a long time. And it can be kind of distressing unless you know that this is just part of the process. The other thing they can do is very shallow. And that can go on for a long time also. It's metabolic. That isn't, most of the time it's not at all associated with anxiety. It's just the way the body is coping with the biochemical changes that are going on inside as they die. We have a respiratory center back here, and when it starts getting different messages, we breathe differently. That's just all there is to it. Then there's the gurgling. That is so distressing. The sounding like somebody's drowning. And for those of us who have been around the medical profession, the first instinct is to get the suction, get that stuff out of there. Getting that stuff out of there is not particularly helpful. It's very distressing to the patient. It can actually stimulate more secretions. What's happening is as the breathing is changing, as the lungs are slowing down, yes, more fluids are collecting. That's part of it. The thing is, in an expected death, nothing, there is nothing that is an emergency. There's nothing that's an emergency. We're not going to do anything. So how do you deal with these horrible, gurgly, awful noises that are coming from your loved one? Well, one of the best pieces of advice I ever heard was from a hospice nurse who said, cover your ears and look at the person. And 99% of the time, if you block out the sound and you look at the person, they look really peaceful. It's not bothering them. It's horrible for those of us in the room, but it's not bothering them. Things you can do, turn them on their side, help some of the secretions drain out so it's not right up here. Washcloth, but please don't fall into the suctioning gang. And if you are in a situation in a hospital, it's okay to say, please don't do that. If you are planning your own, how you want things to be, you can write that in a plan. You can discuss it with your physician. So there's that. So we got this far. Oh, there's color changes that can go on near the end as the circulation changes, and they're particularly easy to pick up in us bleach Caucasians. But the hands and feet get bluish. Again, it's like a newborn. Oh my God. You know, a brand newborn often has blue hands and feet, and we don't worry about it, right? Because the focus of the newborn's body is getting the internal systems working well enough and together, and then push, they start pushing the blood out with better circulation. While we have the doors shut in the other direction, the circulation starts shutting down in the hands and the feet. They get cold, they get blue. Sometimes if the person's lying in one position for a long time, their rear end gets purple, and it's from the blood pooling. It's not an emergency, it's part of the deal. It can be distressing if you're not prepared for it. What am I forgetting?
Smell?
Smells, that's a good one. Thanks, Mark. There can be all kinds of smells. Of course, the incontinence can be an issue. And I'll talk about that for a second. Person loses control of bowel and bladder. Different people, as they approach that themselves, and different families approach that differently. So there's the whole range of stick a catheter in, collect the urine so we don't have to deal with it, or yeah, we just change the bed frequently. It's a reality. The urine, as you get very close to life, the end of life, gets very dark. It can, right near the end, it can look like a cup of coffee with cream in it. It can be very, very dark. And that's actually one of the signs that you're near the end, because the kidneys are shutting down. How to deal with the smells, well, of course, frequent changing is, of course, helpful. Cracking the window. The body can emit from the respiratory system. There's a whole other pile of smells that can come out. If the person has had cancer or a disease that's really eating at their body, those smells can be pretty intense. And so you do what you can to deal with it. If you're dealing with particularly bad sores, you can use fungal powders on them that make the smells much better.
Use aromatherapy under my nose.
Okay, for yourself, taking care of yourself, yeah.
That makes me be able to stay.
Yeah. Michelle?
Yeah.
Also, I carry a little vial of Vicks VapoRub. Because when you go into a situation and there may be cat urine all over the floor, you can't breathe. And so Vicks masks a world of stuff.
That's a good piece of advice. A lot of us just have noses that shut off. It's part of how we deal with it. But families haven't been around it forever. The average person hasn't been around it a lot, and so they don't have this little automatic switch. So those are great suggestions.
I don't have that, but I do use outhouses from time to time, and I just breathe through my mouth, and that helps. Yeah. I'll never forget being in ER when a woman's post-birth, there was an emergency scenario there, and she was, a lot of stuff was coming out of her, and the staff had been dealing with it for a couple of hours, and it was my turn, and I'm not a nurse, bless you, and those of you who are, whoa, but aromatherapy to the rescue, that helped me stay, because I wanted to attend to her, but that's not my world, and you have to do what you have to do. I so appreciate the metaphor, the parallels between sort of the birth midwife and the death midwife or death doula, because as soon as you described, these are the things that you could expect, the reality is it could be different.
It could be different.
And these are a lot of the things that we see, and a lot of the things happen, and sometimes they don't. I would want to say that the patient is our best teacher, and if we can remember that, then we can stay open to the new things that happen. I'll never forget talking with this patient's daughter who had said, Dad has died so many times. It's been about a year, and he gets so close to death, and the whole staff comes running, and we got to say goodbye now, and we're ready, and now's the time, and it's really hard because he comes back, and sometimes he comes back, and he's the mean dad, and sometimes he's the nice dad, but this has been going on for a year, and she's a psychoanalysis person. Very educated, but it's like, how many times is he going to die? We're right in the middle of that conversation, and actually I was at the hospice house where Martha most recently worked, and she came in and said, it's time. His body was purple, his legs were purple, his arms were purple, the back of his body was purple. This is modeling extreme, and it's, here we go. And she'd just been in the room 2 minutes before. And so we walked into the room,
and then Martha is going to show, here it is. That guy's legs are as pink as white. Martha's going, I've never seen that before. And I just looked at her and I said, is that what you're talking about? Yes. So, I mean, come on. Yeah. So it is what it is. As sure as you know, you see those first two stripes that you're pregnant and they give you the date when that baby is going to be born, right? Well, that's the date, except for a baby shows up, wow, 3 months early, or 2 weeks late, or has trisomy 18, has a genetic scenario that changes everything, that makes it so that they're not going to be able to live at all, or not very long. We have the expectations of how that's going to go, and maybe with birth, we kind of know the routine a little better than the death routine because we don't have these kind of conversations, I think. Mm-hmm. If we had more freedom, if we each of us leave here and speak to 10 more people about how awesome life is and how awesome death is. I mean, did you see the reaction when we left the podium today? It's like nobody wants to talk about death, but you're here because you're alongside mm-hmm. in a variety of ways. Mm-hmm. And as soon as we think we know how it's going to go, it's going to be different. Oh, yeah. So we just keep that in.
Yeah, nobody, not very many people read the book.
Yeah. My dad died in the hospice house. He was there 16 hours, got totally irritated, irritable, restless, thought I was poisoning him. So it was time for him to leave the house. Mom promised him that he could stay. And so she wasn't going to let that happen because she made a promise. And I'm standing there trying to keep him in bed because he is as restless as can be. And I said, Mom, you tell. I've been talking to hospice all night. They're ready. They can have the ambulance here. You say the word a couple hours before. She's determined she's going to stay there. I said, Mother, you get to bed right now. and she stomped off, and a couple hours later she went, I'm so sorry. it goes like that. He died in hospice. My brother and sister-in-law were there. My mom opted to leave at about 5 o'clock. He died at 1:30 the next morning. My brother and sister-in-law, and actually Martha and I also left about 9:30. And about 10:30, we got the call, and the nurse said, just like you were saying about that, we call it apnea, that the breathing that maybe they don't take a breath for 30 seconds. I had watched that and said, I know what's coming. I know what these next days are going to take out of me. Mm-hmm. I know what I've given these last 2 weeks to keep him at home, sort of as a CNA and chaplain and daughter and, you know, all the roles that one might play. And I opted to leave and get some rest. And I got a call and the nurse said, we thought he was gone. I mean, he didn't breathe. I mean, we were just preparing and all of a sudden, just like he said, and scared the crap out of us. And I was like, sweetie, why don't you give him 15 minutes next time? Just call me when he's gone. And that was the right way for me and for Mom and for our family. Mm-hmm. And the right way is your right way. So many times at the bedside, family members are trying to get it right. I promised. He said he'd never. We don't want this. We, you know, mm-hmm. all of that. And they're trying so hard to get it right. And that sometimes means you have to be at the bedside or I can't be at the bedside. Well, okay, that's good. If you need to remember him in another way, then you're in the waiting room. I mean, you're here, you're present, and so part of my job as chaplain is to honor all of the roles, all of the ways, all of what's going on, and to normalize it because there's no right.
Yeah. There's no right. And sometimes somebody will go through all those stages really fast, really fast. Only in retrospect can I think, oh, yeah, well, okay, yeah, that, yeah. But as she said, you can't plan. But just like anything else in life, this is the normal way it goes, and you might see all of it, you might see bits of it, or it might be sudden. We hear a lot about, or those of us who are around, that are comfortable with the topic of death, hear a lot about people choosing when they're going to die, and I'm not talking about our Bill 1000 here. I'm talking about when they're spiritually ready to go. And Bill 1000 is the assisted suicide. Okay.
Physician-assisted death.
Assisted death.
Physician-assisted death.
Physician-assisted, thank you very much. I stand corrected. Anyway, I'm sure Cheryl has many stories also of people who they need that last person to come from afar and say goodbye before they can relax. They need that last phone call before they can relax. On the flip side, I've seen so many times family hovering and hovering and hovering. And as soon as they finally go out to lunch or whatever, the person dies. People, somewhere in there, I really believe that there is a, now it is safe for me to go. And we don't always know from the outside what that means. I do know a lot of times with moms, the kids have to go. They have to be out of the room because they don't want to bother the kids with their death. But that's not always the rule. Sometimes there's a mom who loves the attention. So I just wanted to honor the fact that in here, I think each of us have this little thing that is going to know when it's okay to go. And that's a spiritual part. It connects with the physical things that say, okay, this door is okay, we're good with it, I'm going.
Sometimes you can listen to the family story and make an educated guess about that. Mm-hmm. I was called to an in-home hospice scenario and was rather overwhelmed by a huge Hispanic family. There was probably, I was greeted probably by 30 of them that were outside in a covered area. Mm-hmm. And then I went into the living room, and there was probably another 15 or so. And then the patient was in, I guess, her bedroom, and there's probably another 20 people in there. And I started listening to the story, and over time I learned that this lady paid attention to who was present. When the birthday party happened, these old people, okay, he can't come, and blah, blah, blah. And so as I was listening, then they said, oh, well, Uncle so-and-so is not going to come until after the death. And I said, does Mama know that? And they said, they looked at each other and went, I don't think so. So I think maybe it might be a good idea for Mama to know that. And it was so awesome. The kind of the spokesperson daughter got really close to her and just kind of described very tearfully that Uncle So-and-so was not going to be here. And 10 seconds later, maybe 15 seconds later, I heard her breathing change and looked over, and I just said, I think now's the time. She just had to take attendance. She had to know where everybody was and who was going to be there and who wasn't going to be there. Okay, we're all here then. I love that.
I love that too. Yeah.
It was astonishing.
My two experiences being at the end or close to the end of death of a loved one, a friend and my father, I wasn't right there in the room when they died. I did need to go back to the hotel room. I'd been up all night, two nights, mm-hmm. with my father. And we had you know, he knew what was going on. We had conversations. He selected the hymns he wants sung at the funeral, etc. He was ready. I needed sleep, and I left, and I came, went back to the hotel room. I got a call 2 hours later, and he had passed. Another friend, I was there into the night, the snowstorm. I had to go home and get some sleep. I get a call the next morning. She passed during the night, and I really had to deal with the guilt that I wasn't there at the site. And that's all my ego. You know, it had nothing to do with them. I had said my goodbyes. I had done what I could. But selfishly, I wanted to be able to maybe brag about I was there to the end. And so it was important for me, and I'm still learning to let go of me. It's not me that's dying. A part of me is dying with them, but to, you know, do what I can, be a part of it, but then to realize they were ready, you know, and I did what I could.
That's an important piece for families. It could be your voices that bring that healing balm to families who knew they should have been there. Mm-hmm. And that's a deep grief. Sometimes I've worked for days with families after the fact because I promised I'd be there and I should have been there and I couldn't. And the reality is likely it was exactly this little window that gave the patient the go-ahead to take their last breath. So it's
when my mother died, we'd all been there very intensely for several days, and she kept doing the stopping breathing thing. It had gone on for a couple of days, and then someone new would come in and come out of it and talk, and I started calling it. She was holding court. She had to keep holding court until everyone was done. So some of us were getting a little exhausted, and our laundry was way past needing done, and we needed showers. And so this was an Ann Portis. Several of us piled in the car to go back to Bellingham, my daughter included. My daughter was very close to my mother. And sure enough, we get to Bellingham, we get the call. She had died. My daughter was beside herself. Mm-hmm. She had deserted her grandma at her last minutes. And it was, she gets it now. It's been quite a few years, but it was really hard for her to accept that was what her grandma needed, that she needed peace and quiet to be able to slip away. Peacefully. She needed the stimulus to be gone so she could slip away.
I think that's one of our, maybe a myth that we carry on, that we don't want people to die alone. One of my best teachers was a developmentally disabled guy, totally jaundiced. I got on call. He's dying. And his family's in Kentucky. He has no family here. There's nobody there, and something engaged in me that it was like an emergency, and I so loved it when you said there's not an emergency going on. Mm-hmm. And furthermore, it's taken me a while in my own understanding and sense of what death is like is that we're not alone. The songs that we sing, the songs that you bring, you know, I'm there to comfort you, and I'm you know, we're here. And Martha is comforted thousands of miles away. It works that way. And whatever spiritual expression we might have, God says, I will never, never, which means never, leave you or forsake you. And so we're wrapped. We're wrapped in love. And that soothes me sometimes when I start to get agitated or think I need to go, you know, I don't know, be mother is what I was doing back when I was in training. It's like, that guy needs a mother. No, he's got a mother, and I talked to her a few hours later, and this is how it went, and that's the truth, but we can check ourselves. Mm-hmm. About, you know, I really appreciate that, Mark, when you bring up the whole ego piece, and even that I was there. You know, it is something about us, and that's a journey to let go of that. Mm-hmm. But first, recognizing it. So, mm-hmm. so thank you for that.
Mm-hmm. I had a patient as a hospice nurse. He was in an assisted living facility, and he was all by himself in this room, and he was at, thank you, Nancy. This patient was all by himself in the room in assisted living facility. He'd been there for a while. Family didn't come around much, and the staff called saying that he was agitated. Well, duh. Anyway, I have to leave the well does out of it. So I get there, and he's this little, just the epitome of a little old man in bed, scared and alone. And he had a big cross on his wall over his bed. And he wasn't talking, he was beyond talking, and he was definitely in what we call terminal agitation. And so my protocol as a nurse is to give him medication for the terminal agitation. So I gave him some medication, and it wasn't kicking in. And so I looked at the cross on the wall, and I said, okay, I'm going to sing. So I sat there, and I held his hand, and I sang. My repertoire of hymns is about 3. So I sang those over and over again, and he calmed right down, and he passed away shortly after I left. We don't, as people who minister to the dying, when it isn't our family, we don't have control over who's there or what the scenario is going to look like, but there are things we can do that help ease the passage. And that's a big part of why we're here, is the easing of the passage. Not everybody has an Ashley who can come fill in the gap for them. And the things we can do are often very simple. But boy, if I wasn't hooked on Fresh Hope Choir before that experience with that little old guy, I sure was afterwards.
Here's a reading from a book called Making Friends with Death. And it's, I think you might have it in your folder. It's called A Sense of Presence. It's not easy to stop and be present. Our sense of presence is the most powerful gift we can offer. I want to say that again. Our sense of presence is the most powerful thing we can offer. I really liked the matins today. We're so busy being busy. But once we begin to learn to be, being present is, it's an incredible gift. It takes a lot of energy and intention and focus. And it's what we have to give. All of us have that to give. And in turn, we can draw out that quality in others. There's tremendous value in simply being able to sit still and be with another person without pretense. Being present has a quality of stability that can communicate in the midst of activity as well as when we are sitting still. No matter what is swirling around, no matter how chaotic or difficult the situation, the sense of presence is a stabilizing force. When we lose contact with what is going on, we can touch back in through that sense of presence. It is completely reliable, like the earth. In my work, I lose myself sometimes in the tyranny of the urgent. Let me answer your question first.
Just struggling with the other reality that we were naming, which was a little bit in dichotomy with what you just said, because if we get self-important about, for instance, our sense of presence, that's one of the things that makes us different, difficult for us not to be present at the death. Mm-hmm. So it's just trying to, I'm just throwing that out there because I'm just kind of weighing that right now.
Yeah, What does it
and
mean?
What does it mean to have a sense of presence? Does that mean that I'm...
Exactly. Lots of times that's not appropriate.
Yeah.
Yeah,
exactly. She says, I haven't had a hug today.
So that's absolutely appropriate. Let's just open that up. What do you understand as a sense of presence? What does it mean to you to be present?
I think it's our intention around that conflict and just being aware, like Mark was, oh, if we can be aware, this is about my ego and letting go of that and have an intention of being present with no agenda for ourselves or for them. So that idea of intention.
With no agenda.
I think what's key is practice. Just because I want to be present now doesn't mean all of a sudden I'm present. It is not in our vocabulary. For the most part, as citizens of this society, especially, we are busy, busy, busy. We're thinking our present is being ready for the future. How do we get to the next moment? Instead, for me, being present, and I'm doing some work of my own on this because I want to do that, but it's not easy.
So it takes practice, is what you're saying.
It takes practice, and it takes forgiveness. It takes, okay, I'm not there yet, it's a process, I'll probably never arrive, maybe I will, it would be nice to really feel, you know, and that's the whole thing right behind meditation and prayer and a lot of these practices that we do to try to be present, and every once in a while I get a glimpse of it, that it's really, I can really feel present, but yeah, 15 minutes of just sitting still and doing nothing, that's good practice, but it's not easy. Mm-hmm.
In my experience, my ego can never be present. It's not going to happen. You have a moment, I have a moment of presence, and then the ego just says, I was present.
Yes.
And I did a really good job of being present.
The ego wants to co-opt everything and make it its own. And I think, you know, seeing that is kind of alarming at first, but then you just sort of, I found that there's a bigger space that can hold even that. Right. Oh, there's my ego again, doing its little, like, me. And, but I think for presence, it's like, presence is already here. You know, and it's sort of like inviting, like asking, what is already present in me? And just stop. Just stop talking, stop thinking, just invite it forward, you know. And everybody has it, it comes and goes.
Even just when you use the words, just stop. I thought, yeah, right. That's not easy. I like to use the acronym for WAIT, WAIT. Why am I talking? That helps me a lot. Because a lot of times I'm talking. Why? I'm uncomfortable. I'll never forget it's the awful scenario where 16-year-old just has come from tutoring somebody who's just going to go to a band concert, gets hit in the crosswalk. Mom is a hospice nurse. Dad, it takes us a while to find out that he's not the biological dad, nor is he a decision maker, but that takes a little while to figure out. And I went into that room and I did not know what I said. And I didn't do any damage, but I was so uncomfortable. I was so in pain with the pain that was there that I just, there's a bunch of blah blah coming out of my mouth. And I whipped myself about that for a little bit. It turned out that 3 days later we had a care conference and I happened to be the chaplain for that care conference. A care conference at our hospital means
the family, the nurse, the doctor, social worker, maybe family at a distance on the phone, will gather around and say, this is where we've been, this is where we are now, and this is a trajectory of where we're gonna, what this might look like. And the doctor basically described that she couldn't come back. But when I walked in the room, it was like, oh, I so messed up the first round that, and I failed. I made a mess. Why am I talking? I learned in that situation, she didn't even know that she knew me from 3 days before. I mean, it was a nothing to her, but that's that ego again, that we're so busy, you know, trying to get it right, that we sometimes, you know, get full of ourselves that way. In that situation, the doctor said all he could. I'm watching the social worker in tears across the way, and this doctor wants me to talk. And I want to find my voice. And in this situation, the daughter had just sat on mom's bed the week before and said, you know, Mom, if anything ever happened to me, I would want to be an organ donor. Huh? Oh, wow. A 16-year-old. Wow. And that was part of the story that I had heard in the days before. And so that's what I said. I said, you're exactly where no parents ever want to be, ever imagine being, but you're here. And ours is to decide what would she want. And in this case, unlike any other scenario that I can think of, she told you what it means to live. And she actually told you what it means to die. That she would like to live on in others. Her mother held that close to her heart, and it happened just that way. Her dad was going to have none of that. And then we learned that he hadn't been involved for the last 10 years. This was his only sort of offspring child person. And he was just in a great deal of pain. So trying to hold all of this and figuring out whose voices, who can hear, what needs to be said, what needs to be not said, all of that is part of that. I realized I had spoken to his mom a couple days before, and all of us were hoping, and she was the greatest cheerleader, this guy's mom, that this girl would live. And so I found her, and I said, I think he needs to hear from you. I can't. I said, I think you're in the kingdom for such a time as this. I knew that they were Christian, and I just said, I think it is exactly your voice who has been hoping, leading the cheerleading, who can also say, it's time. She'd come back if she could, but she can't. And we have to let her go. And it was that voice who helped him get what he needed, because he wasn't going to hear it from me. I was the bad guy. But it's okay. We're in it together. We're community. We offer what comes to our own spirits to say. A lot of times I have something that comes to my mind, and I am talking while nothing's coming out of my mouth, going, no way, I'm not going to say that. Are you kidding me? Fat chance. No, in no uncertain terms, I am not going to say that, which ultimately, because I've learned to do it, is to say, I'm just going to say this because it's in me to say. And it's usually, you know, something painful to hear. Mm-hmm. And almost always, probably always, it's exactly what they needed to hear. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes we're at the bedside speaking those words of truth. Oftentimes I say to families, they go, well, we don't want them to know what's going on. Mm-hmm. Well, In me, I'm saying, do you think he doesn't know? Why don't say that? I mean, he's the guy that's gasping for breath. And do you think he doesn't know something's changed? But I don't say that like that. I just say, I suspect that
he knows that he's coming down towards the end of his life, and now's a precious time that you have him with, where you can say those most important things. Ira Byock wrote the four, isn't it called the four most important things? A book that talks about the I love yous and the thank yous and the words of forgiveness. Sometimes the end of life, it's packed with a whole lot of work that a patient hasn't done before. That's hard. It's hard to watch. And sometimes this particular part of it is one of the hardest things that I ever face. And that is when a family, after the patient is probably intubated, maybe been intubated, has the tube in, we're breathing for them, they're not going to come back and talk to us. That time is gone. We're done with that chapter. So I describe it kind of like that. But it's the families who say, will you go in there and make sure that he accepts Jesus Christ as personal Lord and Savior?
Oh, God.
That one is hard for me.
I don't get that. You get that.
Well, I'm saying it, yeah, as a chaplain, and I'm saying it as this is a kind of hope and expectation that family comes loaded with, some of them, at the end of life. You didn't get it done before. Get in there and get it done. What I have learned to say is, when did you come to faith? Because there's a story, and usually there's a moment that happened. Mm-hmm. And oh, you were 45, and you came to faith. And how is it that you came to faith? Well, then they tell their story. And then I say something like, could you hold the possibility that the Beloved is absolutely present, like the Beloved has always been present, and that work, although it's unseen to us, we might not get the, and I try to not say magic words, I have a couple times, but just to hold that possibility that after communication as we know it is no longer, that doesn't mean communication isn't going on. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know what happens after the last breath. I mean, I haven't been there. I'm fascinated by the people that come back and tell us. I might be able to remember the book. I heard it on tape. A woman from India, she tells her story about how she was supposed to get married, and she didn't want to get married because she was intelligent and she wanted to... In India,
just stop with it.
People. In India, there's a plan for you if you're female. And she didn't want that plan. She wanted to get an education. It turned out that her dad died before Prince Charming came along, and they did get married. And then the cancer came, and then she went, I guess she was living in Hong Kong, she went to India. Anyway, her body is full of cancer. She dies for 32 hours. And she tells a story of meeting up with her dad, of hearing music like you've never heard music, of seeing color that cannot be described, of talking with her girlfriend who had died before of cancer, of having nothing of judgment from her dad, only love. All this is going on while she's, medically they would call it comatose, and doing all the magic, but that's where she went. And came the time that she came back into her body. Of course, they grab the husband and everybody's celebrating, and the doctor comes in and she says, well, Dr. Smith. And he's going, yes? And she says, that's your name, right? Well, yeah, but you can't know that. And she said, well, didn't you put a needle in my back about 5 hours ago? And he's going, well, yeah, but anyway, I'll think of the book because it's her story of how she learned love and how she learned non-judgment and how she learned to live life after death after life.
I think it's dying to be me.
That's it. Dying to be me. She tells the story, and I mean, they can't believe it. I mean, she also knew when she came back she would have no cancer, and that was true. But of course, the medical world doesn't believe that. So, dying to be me. She has to undergo all of these tests, all of the, you know, X-rays and all that stuff. And the X-ray technician is looking at this riddled body, and then here's this X-ray, and he calls guy and says, "What am I supposed to biopsy?" And he's going, "Well, anything that won't hurt her too much." I mean, I'm saying the story because of the angst that I have working where I do. That's the bottom line. We do stuff at hospitals that doctors tell me they would not do them to themselves or to their family. We do CAT scans because we can. Especially that last week or two of end of life, where some families require it. We take a CAT scan at when a patient comes in, and we probably are going to compare that brain bleed that's taken a third of the brain in 2 days, it's taking a three quarters of the brain, and that helps a family go, oh, grandma really isn't there. But many, many of the things that we do in hospitals, I don't really think need to be done.
This is an excellent segue into the pulse.
Go.
Into what?
Into the pulse. That green paper.
The green paper. The green paper. The bright lime green paper is pulse stands for physician orders life-sustaining treatment. Physician orders for life-sustaining treatment. So, this is a form where you choose first, do I want to be resuscitated or not? Pretty clear question, okay? Yes or no. If it is yes, then you have some other choices. Either way you have other choices. Let me start over. Do I want to be resuscitated or not? If I'm found with no pulse and I'm not breathing, do I want to be resuscitated? So you say, no, I don't want to be resuscitated. You know, I'm 80-something years old, I don't want to be resuscitated. Okay, well, your body might hang in there. So what kind of treatment do you want then? Do you want just comfort? Do you want to have them start an IV and give you fluids? Do you want to be rushed to the hospital and have all kinds of monitoring? Even though you don't want to be resuscitated, if you're body is still alive, what do you want? These are all pretty nuts and bolts questions, and it's really hard for people to imagine. And there's also the do you want tube feeding questions. It's hard to imagine ahead of a terminal diagnosis what you might think. It's hard enough for people with a terminal diagnosis to say, well, yeah, this is what I want. And it is vital that you address these questions if you want to have any kind of say in what's going on. So I'm not just saying this to you, I'm saying this to you to pass on, to pass on, to pass on, because the reality is you plop down, someone's going to call 911, you're going to end up in the emergency room.
Unless you get a tattoo that says DNR.
Right.
Right.
And that might not. That,
that
may not,
doesn't
no,
happen.
That's not legal.
That one is pissed off.
Yeah, that one.
But you want to do that because how on earth are you going to get your wishes fulfilled? Because we
see over and over and over and over again in the medical profession, people who have been saying, I just want to go peacefully, but they haven't done their footwork to protect themselves should things not quite go by their plan and other people are making decisions for them. So it's really important to start thinking about this, because we have in this country the reality of 911. People are going to call 911. Everybody knows you dial 911. 911 comes. If you do not have this posted where they can see it, and if it's not signed by a physician, they are required by law to resuscitate and transport. And they get you to the hospital, and there goes any kind of control if you don't have something in writing signed by a physician ahead of time. It's different from advance directives. It's more concrete. Advance directives are very important. The pulse is even more so because it is so clear. Yeah.
Well, Michelle, if I'm driving my car and I have a directive posted on my refrigerator and I have a heart attack, they're not going to know about it. So is there a wallet size?
There are wallet pulses, and you have it registered with your physician and have it registered at the hospital.
So
anytime you are in the medical system, make sure your pulse information in. We all have electronic medical records now. Okay. Make sure it's updated in your electronic medical records.
That's awesome.
Because you arrive at the hospital, they look it up and they say, oh, she's DNR. Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Can I just expand on that?
Yeah.
A little bit.
Lovely.
So, for example, like in Milwaukee County in Bellingham, where I'm from, they have a program there which is national now, which is that with the electronic records, no matter where you are, if you're visiting friends in Tennessee, but you happen to be from Bellingham, if you get hit by a car in Tennessee, they're going to not know who your little doctor is in his private practice and not be able to get access to your advance directives or your pulse in that way. Chances are you don't have it in your back pocket when you get hit. So the way the system works now is that the hospital that you get taken to in Tennessee is going to look and find out where you live. Then they're going to call the major hospital in that area, which in Bellingham is easy because we only have one hospital, and they will look for any advance directives and or pulse. And it's really important that those get registered in your town at whatever major hospital you have, even if you have no intention to ever be seen at that hospital by that facility in any way. So you have your little doctor or your naturopath that you go see, you still register your advance directives and your pulse at the hospital so that if you get hit in Tennessee, they can get access to those records and be able to stop the interventions even if they have been started.
Okay. And that's more the case that these days, as soon as somebody gets into ER and isn't breathing, they are going to be intubated.
Mm-hmm.
But we can turn that around
within
a half an hour. If the wife says he wouldn't want this, and I've done that before, stood at the doctor's face to face and said, this is his wife and they don't want this. And then they'll back off and that wife is still saying, thank you for being there, because it's a day or two in ICU with all of the bells and whistles we can do. And then you have to decide 2 days later.
Yeah, I recently learned of a resource, and I believe it's beyond Seattle. I know it's in Seattle, called Compassion and Choices. Mm-hmm. And their whole mission is to provide, at no cost to anyone, counseling, paperwork, information about how to do exactly these things. And they even have now an advanced directive for people with Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia. I was stunned by the level of support and paperwork.
Nancy, is that the same as the Choice magazine, the Choice organization, or is it called Compassion?
They call themselves Compassion and Choices. It's a stunning organism.
They have the best advanced directives I have seen, and they're far superior to the Five Wishes or to any of the other ones that are out there. Compassion and Choices is great advanced directives because it provides specifically, you can put different timelines in your advanced directive. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I'll be on life support for a week, but if I don't pull it through in a week, then unplug me. You can put different kinds of time frames, because if I'm 45 and I have a heart attack, sure, give me a go. And then if I don't make it, pull it, right? So it's a lot more real to a real life versus a pulse form, which is really, really, like, you get option A or B in a couple of different choices, and it's very, very simplified.
Mm-hmm. Compassion
and choices.
Can I ask, too, we have this lovely clipboard here, collecting resources, and we've mentioned four or five things already, so can we make sure they get on the clipboard so we can make copies for everybody before you leave? Any movies, books, websites, any of this?
You had. Well, I was wondering if the compassion and choices, because I know I learned about five wishes in Colorado. The church did a two-part series on death and dying. And so I know that that's nationwide. Would these forms be?
Yeah. They're nationwide, and they also have some state-specific forms. Like in Washington, we have Death with Dignity, so there's some additional things that you can look at there versus some states that don't have that. Those feasibilities.
I'm actually glad to have heard about that resource, which might be helpful in the scenario that I'm asking about, which is this. I'd be glad to hear your wisdom. And maybe it's nothing more than, you know, the fickleness of human beings. I'm a parish pastor, and there's a family in our congregation. Both of the matriarch and patriarch are both 82. They've suffered some terrible losses in the last couple of years. The husband is a retired medical doctor, and his health has been very fragile over the last year and a half. And I think he at least has an advance directive which stipulated no intubation, but for whatever reason, a few months ago, he was intubated. Mm-hmm. And he survived, and actually was able to go home, and his wife, I believe, understands that she could not bear his death right now. They will be married 60 years in June, and I think things might change after that. But more recently, he had another medical crisis, and he was asked, he could respond, he was asked about intubation, and he said yes, even though his advanced medical director says no. I don't know how things are going to unfold for him. He's, you know, on dialysis now and so on. But could you, what wisdom can you add to that kind of?
It happened. He had a success. It went against his wishes. He had a success, and he's hanging on to that. They have their 60th anniversary coming. He has every reason to be resuscitated and intubated and whatever else it takes to get there. He has a goal.
And as long as he has voice and is determined to be of sound mind, if he's decisional.
He's a very sound mind.
That's the language that we use. If he can make that decision himself, we want it to come from his voice. If he cannot, then we need to take the family and the pulse and any other piece of information. But still, it's about what he wants, and so the conversation, a lot of times that I find myself in, is ultimately after the doctor says this is where we are and this is where we're going, the family often is in tears by then, and I'll simply say, if Grandma was sitting here, what would she say? She wanted. And I just make it real. She can't talk to us now. She needs to have your voice. And you know, what did Grandma like to do? She's a gardener, and she cooks, and she, you know, all that stuff. Well, if Grandma couldn't do those things, you know. And finally, and often, it happens that somebody says, she wouldn't want what we're doing now. And almost all the other heads bob. And then, I mean, sometimes they have to figure out, do we do that intubation and
whoa, we won for a little while longer, or, yeah. It's hard.
I have a question for this rose to mind. A friend's recollection of her illness. She was very, very sick in the hospital to the place where she could not respond, but she was aware of what was going on. Mm-hmm. And they asked her husband in her presence, do you want her to be resuscitated? And she said, I could hear this whole exchange. Mm-hmm. And I was saying in my head, well, Austin, of course you do. Mm-hmm. But she said, I couldn't do anything about it. And she said, he went on, was silent for a long time. And finally said, well, of course. But she said, it was very disturbing to hear this. And now she's well, and she's doing quite, you know, she's my age. And
where's Oscar?
Austin, her husband? Oh, they're still...
Okay, good.
I think what happened, was that he was so overwhelmed with emotion. But to her, it sounded like... I'm sure they talked it out. Yeah. Well, do you or don't you?
So let's point out one thing that is in the bookstore, which, by the way, they're keeping open until 12:15, and then it'll be open again Monday morning. But these just came in, and this is an Oregon edition and a Washington edition, a practical guide to making your own end-of-life healthcare decisions called In Advance. I'll pass them around. But apparently they have a lot of the forms, a lot of the things we've been talking about.
I just was going to say that that is the perfect, like, textbook, put it on film reason for doing advanced directives and having that pulse form and having that conversation beforehand with your family so that they, in their grief and in their shock, aren't left trying to remember and sort through their own emotions of what would be the right choice, that they can refer to something that you wrote that says, this is my choice. So that she wouldn't be in that situation of having it all on him when he's like completely buried in his own emotional process and trying to come up with that choice.
I just want to say, back on the prior example, when the very lucid former doctor says, now I want to be intubated, is there that incumbent on the family to update those forms?
Well, and I think for him and his own spiritual journey right now, part of it is one of the questions that he's living with and really living with. He's one of my favorite parishioners for this simple reason that he wants to engage in those important questions. And so he's wrestling with what is a life of quality for me? He hated giving up his medical license. It was a tremendous grief for him. But he's led a lot of adult classes in our church, and his health doesn't really permit that anymore. But he had a kind of a little men's group, and now at least one of the men will go to his house every Monday because that's when they used to meet. So is that enough? If Alan can still come to his house and they can have these conversations. So I think it's still unfolding for him, and that's why there's that ambiguity.
But I would just think, like, once he says so clearly in a lucid state of, I do want to be intubated.
Under these circumstances.
Exactly. Should the family be bringing him that form again? Or is it like you just leave the form that's filed that said no intubation?
His daughter will do that.
Mm-hmm. And our hospital will be changed to full code.
Yeah, it would be changed.
It'll be changed because it came
in. Maybe she had signed something, but she was unable to respond, but was obviously there. What if the directive had been no resuscitation and she had no way to?
There's
other ways. When she's there, there's ways to know somebody's there and unable to talk.
Even if she can't speak, she can write.
Sometimes we use eye blinks. Sometimes we use, there's other ways to communicate.
Yeah, that was very disturbing
to get that, to make sure we get that right.
You're stuck.
We're heading towards the last 10 minutes. I want to ask, do you have any other questions, or if you don't want to say them out loud, would you write them down specifically about... especially physiologically, what happens at death? Just things you've observed or thought or seen or wondered about?
In the second half, we're going to hopefully just go with it and see where we go. We're both very curious to see where this is going to go. So if you're not comfortable asking, then go ahead and write. There's a little thing in your...
I don't know if there's information to let people know. I'm just so aware of the different types of death experiences people have. Somebody falls asleep and doesn't get up in the morning, or they drop over from a heart attack, or they're shot, or they're in a horrible terror situation. Do we know how many people have these kinds of deaths? And is it a different experience? And I don't know if there's a way of knowing.
I was called to a scenario where a 45-year-old guy shot himself in the head with a shotgun. And my first experience with the family was with his wife, who was sobbing and doubled over, and his mom and dad and his siblings. And the doctor said, well, probably, you know, given where the gun wound is, he might not walk or talk or see or hear, I mean, whatever that whole thing was. And then he kicks me under the table, like, okay, it's my turn. And I just said, I'll call him Bill. From everything that we can see, Bill intended to die. And even if he could recover physically, we don't know if he has the life force, the life will to keep going. So that's going to be part of what we're looking at as well. All of his siblings described how a couple weeks before everybody was talking about, well, I would want everything done. Well, no, I don't really want that stuff. And he said, just push me off the cliff. And they described how all the good stuff in his life he sabotaged. Mm-hmm. And so here's this guy who wants out. Mm-hmm. I went to meet him a day later in his hospital room in ICU. And he didn't die. He worked really hard at communicating with me. And at that point it was... and I couldn't get it. His wife came in. I don't remember what that I think he was trying to say wife or something. Anyway, just fast forward. That guy became one of the most spiritual guys I have known in the hospital. He shared his faith, his newfound faith, with people who also became people of faith in rehab. And he, we had to take a big chunk of his bone out of his head. So he came back 4 months later to have the bone put back in. He's a father to his kids. He's a changed man. Another woman took all the drugs she could think of, was killing animals just for fun, it was a tough story. Awful things had happened to her in her life. Her ex-mother-in-law was there. Her mother-in-law, during this hospitalization, said, I don't know her. Abandoned her. Friday, I just went day to day like y'all. You're at the bedside. Sometimes I just breathe with. I'm watching all this black stuff coming out. I never saw her eyes. That was Friday. Come Saturday, Sunday, don't work usually those days. I came in on Monday, checked the census, and she wasn't in ICU anymore. So I figured she died. But then she was in on the third floor. What? So I went up there, and she was sitting cross-legged on her bed, fully clothed. And I don't know what I must have looked like, but I'm just going, welcome back. And she said, well, thanks, and you would be, Cheryl. I've been with you every day. And she goes, can I tell you where I was? Yeah. So, and she described how she also met the beloved, how she came to know the wreck she was making of her life, what her life meant, the purpose of her life. Ever since then, I cannot say definitively anything. Because there's too, God is too big.
Yes. We are so not in charge.
The mystery is so, we're so not in charge. But if we can hold that sacred space large enough so that people can do, oftentimes it's their end of life work. Sometimes it's reconciliation and forgiveness. Once a pastor had never exactly told his second family that there was a first family. And this daughter came, was invited to the bedside to say goodbye to dad, and was absolutely welcomed by her half-sisters as she was saying goodbye to her dad. Thank you. I mean, when that kind of grace and mystery and forgiveness, I mean, anything can happen. And it depends on people's willingness. So my dad died. He was on his way out, and he was wondering if he had gotten it all done. And he was in the military, and he just didn't think he got it all done. And he was an accountant, so he was the man of the lists and the books and get it. You know, does this equal that? It has to. And I just said, Dad, you did. You got it all in Okinawa. You took care of all of it. And then you came back for Korea. And I just kind of told him his story. And all along, he's saying, I hope so, honey. I hope so. And I said, Dad, I'm proof. You did a good job. I'm here. And you taught Mom how to do the checkbook. She's good, too. We got this, Dad. Oh, honey, I hope so. And he kind of died hoping so. You know, some people know when they die. Some people hope.
It's break time, but my mom died in 2001 of Alzheimer's. And my sister flew out and left 5 days before Mom was able to die because she couldn't remain. But we gave her permission. We just said, Mama, it's okay. We promised to take care of each other. And we kind of just closed the loops and told her who she's going to get to reunite with.
Yes.
And I felt such a sacred presence in that room that entire time. And I wasn't alone, and she and I weren't the only ones in the room. I really sensed loving presences back of the wall.
The balcony people. Yeah. The great cloud of witnesses. Yeah, the great cloud of witnesses that accompany us. I was reading the stuff that Martha sent, and it talks a lot about letting go, and lots of times you say, you know, you have to invite, I mean, let them know that it's okay to go, it's okay to go. And quickly for a break, the first doctor, my first call, right when I started my residency as a chaplain, he just go, you must be the new chaplain, as I'm standing there going, you know, and here's this lady that's dying. And, yeah, that would be me. And afterwards he said, I just got to tell you a story. My mom was here, and this guy was here, and this whole bunch of people, all the family came in and just said, it's okay, Dad, you can die. I mean, not die, you can die, but it's okay, you can go now. Mm-hmm. Da, da, da. And just like a series, 6, 7, 8, 10 people, it's okay, you can go now. He sat straight up and said, damn it, I'm going to go, and I'm damn good and ready to go. Okay. So hold on to your shorts when you do this kind of work. I mean, people do it their way, and that was his way. And it was like, yeah, I got this. I got, you know, after the 4th, 5th, 6th birthday, it's like, I got this. I'm going when I'm, you know. And that's, I say it with humor, because I think there's humor in life and living, and humor in death and dying as well. And I hope you don't hear sacrilegious in any way. I just have seen the craziest things. And you will too. You have. So our next session, again, if you want to write questions, do pop them down there. There's a little piece of paper in your folder there. Otherwise, this next session is going to be more about the grief journey and anything else that you, whatever's on your heart. We want this to be as specific, as helpful, as intimate as you want it to be.
There are also a few folders left here that people haven't picked up, so if you wanted one and didn't get one yet, here it is, and there are pens to write your name on, so it can come back to you if it gets up somewhere.
Okay, thank you so much.
We need a song.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
song. You got one?
Yes, I got one.
One of the three hymns.
We are all walking each other home. We are all walking each other home. We are all walking each other home. We are
the bridge, a booklet about end of life that was made at Cadillac where I work, about before the time of death, what happens right after death, funeral home, resources that we have in our community, and poetry and lots of things. So I brought enough booklet for everyone.